is J. Richard Middleton, who will speak to us on what does it mean to be made in God's image, Genesis 1:26, in ancient biblical and modern cultural context. Richard, will you tell us a little about yourself?
Okay. I'm not a scientist, and I've only recently joined the ASA. My fields are philosophy and biblical studies, and my main interests at the moment happen to be at the intersection of those fields, particularly in the realm of intellectual history and worldviews, whether Christian worldview or worldviews of the Western culture or other kinds of worldviews. If you have trouble following my accent, I'm a Jamaican. I've been socialized, and my accent has been changed slightly over about 9 years of living in Canada and the States, but it's still there. This paper, compared to other papers given on the image of God topic, is going to be rather controversial because, in a sense, I'm challenging a lot of things people say. But I'm open to challenge, too, and I hope that you'll dialogue with me if you think I'm wrong. My paper has a much more narrow focus than many of the other papers on the image of God. I want to ask the question, what is the meaning of the statement in Genesis 1:26 that we are made in God's image? See, I think that I can work in what our first speaker spoke about as the image of God, which is on the board here. I'm not even going to touch that, though. I think that gets towards the New Testament teaching on the renewal of the image, but I want to start much further back. And as I come to the history of interpretation of the image of God, I notice that there are a few things that trouble me, a few things that concern me. One of them is the often made claim by scholars, whether theologians or biblical scholars, that the immediate context of the statement in Genesis 1:26 gives us no help whatsoever in understanding the meaning of the image of God in humanity. As a result of believing this, most scholars have then looked outside the Bible, as Boswell suggested, for the source of the content of that term. I think Norman Snaith, an Old Testament scholar, has summarized the situation quite adequately when he says, many Orthodox theologians through the centuries have lifted the phrase, the image of God, right out of its context, and like Humpty Dumpty, they have made the word mean just what they choose it to mean. Without going into the history of interpretation of the term, which would be very long, but I'll answer questions about that, suffice it to say here that what we desperately need is a contextual, exegetical study of the image of God idea in Genesis. That is the only way, it seems to me, that's a starting point to determine what it means that we are made in God's image. And also, I think, that's a starting point for determining what it means to live in the image of God. In attempting to determine what the meaning of the image of God is in Genesis, I want to look at four contexts. If time doesn't permit, I'm going to skip probably the third, but we'll see if I can fit that in. The four contexts are these. First of all, we need to look at the immediate context, Genesis 1:1 to 2:4a, the literary unit in which Genesis 1:26 occurs. Secondly, I want to look at Psalm 8, which is often regarded as a commentary on Genesis 1:26 to 28. Also on Genesis 2, which combines Conrad Heyer's point he made if you had been to that lecture. Third, I want to examine some relevant elements of the ancient Near Eastern idea of kingship, which plays some background role in interpreting the text. And then finally, I want to look at, which is perhaps the most interesting to me dimension of this, the idea of idolatry and its connection to humanity in God's image. My own thesis in this paper is that whatever else you want to add onto the image of God term, you need to start with the idea that it speaks about our status and function as God's royal representatives in creation. Let me develop that first from the immediate context. It's widely recognized, and people have said this in the conference, that Genesis 1 is a polemic against certain mythological pagan ideas of creation. For example, the ease with which God, Elohim, orders the deep, the watery deep, Tehom, into a structured cosmos is contrasted with, for example, in the Babylonian myth, the Enuma Elish, this warring battle of monsters and gods, out of which, in the final climactic battle, after a lot of pages if you read it, Tiamat, the sea monster, has to be slain by Marduk, the sun god, and out of her dead body, the world is created. That's a clear contrast. about the power of Yahweh. But there's another polemic that I want to mention that's not as often recognized. That is, it concerns the role and status of human beings. In various myths, including the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian myth, humanity is created for the purpose of servitude, to relieve the burden of the lower gods who have to serve the higher gods, so they might have rest. Now in Genesis 2, God rests after creating humanity, but there's a very different significance to Yahweh's rest. But to see that, we've got to look at Genesis 1 a little more. In the beginning, says Genesis, God, Elohim, created the heavens and the earth, presumably out of nothing, but that's not stated there. And then out of that dark, brooding ocean, that formless, empty earth, he formed and shaped a cosmos. God gave form to the formless mass and filled the empty world. Various scholars have pointed out that the first 3 days of creation have to do with God dividing and separating what was formless, thereby giving it form and structure. While days 4, 5, 6, God fills these separated empty spaces with mobile creatures, sun, moon, stars, birds, fish, animals, human beings. Whether or not that, well, no, I'm going to skip that for a minute. Come back to that. I want to note also the manner in which God does this. God creates in Genesis 1 primarily not by creation out of nothing, but by creation by the Word, which is a different mode of creation, which, if you look at the rest of the Old Testament and the ancient Near East, is a royal image. It's an image of the king seated in a throne room uttering royal decrees which are to be obeyed. Let there be light, and there was light. God was obeyed. It also reflects the covenantal tradition of the Old Testament, where Yahweh rules over Israel by means of Torah, laws, decrees, and statutes, which are given for their benefit, to which they are to respond in obedience. And furthermore, God's rule in Genesis 1 consists essentially of a process of development, whereby God changes a formless world into a structured cosmos. God develops the creation. So then throughout Genesis 1, we've got a picture of God as king, which, as we heard from Dr. Wilcox this morning, is the primary biblical image anyway. God as king exhibiting royal authority over the creation by having dominion, and then says, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the livestock and all the earth, and so on. And God made man in his image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. And he said to them, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it and rule over, etc. So it's my contention that far from this text providing no clues to understanding Genesis 1:26, there is an intentional analogy between the ultimate sovereignty of the Creator God and our limited authority in the creation. Human beings, male and female, have been made like God precisely in being given royal authority and a realm to subdue. With that far, I'm going to skip a bit here. One note that the contrast then between this image of the person in Genesis 1 and the Babylonian idea, which claims that we're mere slaves of the gods created for menial servitude. Instead of doing the dirty work of the gods, so to speak, Genesis 1 says we have been made to do God's own proper work, that is ruling. And at the beginning of Genesis 2, when God rests on the seventh day from the work of creation, the contrast is very significant with the Babylonian myth, because we don't have the abdication of a petty deity from burdensome toil. Instead, we have, dare I say, the self-limitation of the creator of the universe, by which he entrusts authority and responsibility for the running of creation, at least of the earth. That is great human dignity. That is a royal status. And that is what the poet in Psalm 8 is amazed by when he looks at the cosmic heavens and sees his own insignificance and says to God, what is man that you're mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? And yet you've made him a little lower than Elohim, a word which can be translated God or gods, because El is a singular word for God, and there's great controversy. The Septuagint, one of the Greek translations, says angels, referring to the translation of gods, the heavenly court. Many other translations, Greek translations, say God, theos. The New Testament picks up the angels one in Hebrews 2. There really, however, is not much difference between these two meanings, because the primary characteristic of deity is to rule. And angels are called gods because they have a ruling function, which is a standard Jewish theological point. And the angels are part of God's court attendants. When God holds court in the Old Testament, as in Ezekiel, reigning upon the chariot throne in the glory with the winged cherubim flying around, it's a royal picture. Revelation 4, when John is caught up to heaven and sees the throne room of God, the one seated on a throne, reigning over history. There are these four living creatures and 24 elders around him. And you could go through many of these pictures in the Old Testament. One important one, I think, is Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah is called of God to be a prophet. There he sees Yahweh seated on a throne, high and lifted up, and these winged beings are flying around. God says, "Who will go for us? Who shall I send?" Speaking in the royal we there represents speaking on behalf of the court attendants, as we find in Genesis 1:26. Let us make man in our image, in our likeness. God is including angels in the image of God there. And that's a theme that biblical theologians point out over and over again. We have been made, says Genesis 1, like the angels, in the image of God, in the specific sense of sharing in God's royal dominion over creation. It may sound audacious, but we are divine and godlike in that one limited sense, that God has delegated authority to us over creation. Okay, I'm going to skip some of the ancient Near Eastern stuff. We can get into that in questions if you want. And I'm going to go down to my final context, the context of idolatry. Conrad Hayers pointed out in his book, The Meaning of Creation, and in his lecture, if you went to it, that the royal noble image in Genesis 1 is counterbalanced by a humbler picture of Genesis 2, and in fact by the tragic picture of Genesis 3, human beings in sin. Now, I'm not so sure that Genesis 1 and 2 are really that different, and I'll answer questions about that, but I won't get into it now. Instead, what I'd like to do is to focus on this second contrast, human sin. Because doesn't the idea of human sin contradict the image of God idea? And theologians always ask that question. Are we still in the image of God after the fall? Well, there are arguments for and against. Rarely, however, has much exegetical work been done on the subject. People point to Genesis 5, 1-3, Genesis 9, 6, which are the two other Genesis passages on the image of God. They point to passages in James and 1 Corinthians, which say that we're made in God's image. Because the other image of God passages in the New Testament don't say we're made in God's image. They speak of the renewal of the image as if it was lost or distorted. So what sense do you make of all this? The point I want to make is that between Genesis 9:6, that is the last reference in the book of Genesis that we're made in God's image, and the New Testament, there's not one single reference in the entire Old Testament that says we're made in God's image. So could it be an important Old Testament idea? And yet, references to images abound, but these images are idols. Idolatry is a pervasive topic in the Old Testament. Both Old and New Testaments condemn idolatry as the epitome of sin, because, as Paul says in Romans 1, it consists in worshipping the creature rather than the creator. But God alone is worthy of worship. God alone is the only true king whose rule we ought to submit to. So if we reject God's rule in our lives, we've in essence committed ourselves to a life of disobedience. We don't need to obey God's Torah for our lives if we reject, in principle, his rule. So idolatry is the heart of disobedience. And it's fair to say that Genesis 3 portrays, in essence, an idolatry of the heart, where Adam and Eve want to be like God, and therefore reject the command of God. And people often talk about Genesis 3 as an act of idolatry, a spiritual act of idolatry. Yet the intriguing fact is that there are no idols mentioned in Genesis 3. Yet idolatry in the whole Old Testament is portrayed as the key human sin from which all others follow. There are no physical images in Genesis 3. There was no attempt on the part of Adam and Eve, according to the writer, to construct a visual representative of the deity. And indeed, the entire section of what we call primeval history, Genesis 1-11, the pre-patriarchal section of the book, even the account of the Tower of Babel, which is a very idolatrous sort of thing, trying to reach heaven, this whole section of Genesis contains no reference to idolatry. in the sense of images. Well, could there be a connection between the lack of false images in early Genesis and the references in chapters 1, 5, and 9 to humanity as the image of God? The connection is suggested, first of all, by the fact that the word used in Genesis 1 for image, tselem, is used at various points in the Old Testament for images, false gods, false images. In fact, it seems to be a problem among Old Testament scholars why Genesis 1 chose that word, because its semantic range limits its meaning to a statue or carved or molten copy. It's a concrete image. And scholars reason that the word for likeness, demut, was added because it's a more abstract term, and it is meant to indicate the image doesn't consist in the visual likeness of the statue, and human beings don't look like God. That's not the point, though Calvin wanted to add that the upright statue of man probably is part of the image of God. It was a common idea in those days, not in these days. So I want to look more clearly at what the idea of being an image of a God was in the Old Testament. I've already noted, well, I didn't note it because I skipped that part, that in Egypt, the king was often called the son and image of the god, in the sense that he had delegated authority from the god to rule. Now, an idol had a similar function, because an idol was viewed as the local means by which a deity became present to the worshipper. An idol was a visible embodiment of the god or goddess. It mediated and manifested the god's glory and rule. It was a physical representation of the god's presence in power. This suggests that idolatry and human dominion over the earth are alternative but incompatible ways to image or represent God. It suggests further that our creation in God's image consists also in our bodily representation of God, not in our, the physical likeness, but in the fact that the whole person, and not just an inner spiritual part, is in God's image and is meant to represent him. We reflect God's glory on earth by our total physical presence. Visibility is of the essence. To be the image of God, you've got to be physically there. Jesus is the image of the invisible God, because we fail in that task. Okay. Idolatry is wrong, therefore, not because it tries to make God visible, which is the human task, in my opinion, but because it goes about this task in the wrong way. Instead of accepting and fulfilling our created responsibility to reflect God's presence in everything we do, including in our dominion over creation, our cultural development of the earth, our scientific work, we project this responsibility onto idols. We therefore deny our calling to live in such a way that God's loving rule can be seen, and we begin to cultivate the earth in disobedience. Idolatry is thus the illegitimate alternative to imaging God in everything that you do. That means idolatry is a twofold phenomenon. It's of the heart. It means rejecting the rule of the true God and worshipping something in creation, but it also means false imaging. Notice the first two commandments in Exodus 20. You shall have no other gods before me, and you shall not create a graven image. Those are two distinct commandments. They warn against substituting for the true God a false God, and substituting for the true image of God, humanity, a false image. One detracts from the honor and glory of God, and one detracts from our dignity and honor and glory, our royal status in creation. The significance of this, I think, and this is where I'm going to try and apply this a little bit here in the last 7 minutes or so we have. I'll try and be very quick so we can get a question or two. Is that I believe, and this is pure speculation, so I'm asking for some response, ancient cultures which had idols, the images, were cultures in which people lived in fear and trembling, controlled by a priesthood. They lived a religion which they could not stand in the direct presence of God, because it was always mediated by an external authority. I think perhaps the end of the Middle Ages was a similar phenomenon, and that's why Luther and others reacted against that and asserted the dignity of humanity, the priesthood of the believer, the vocation of each Christian. You don't have to go through a priest. The other alternative to that, at the far extreme, is modern culture, modern secular culture, where we don't have these images out there, but we don't acknowledge that we are made in the image of God either. What we do is we claim to be God. We do away with images. It means a religion of boldness. We can conquer the world. We are autonomous humanity. We function as God. The image of God notion is not exactly a balance between those extremes, but it avoids those two extremes totally. It says we are indeed lords of creation, but subject to the Creator. We are only an image, we're not the original. The earth doesn't belong to us. We are stewards. We are managers of an estate accountable to the owner. That gives great dignity to what it means to be human. But it also means that we are nothing in ourselves. We are mere creatures. But wonderful creatures, says the psalmist in Psalm 8. Okay, I'm going to cut there, so we've got about 5 minutes for questions. It wasn't much significant. It had to do with dynastic succession. The gods gave the kingship to the first king who passed it down. The flood was a time when the kingship was cut off. And the myths have the gods coming back down to earth and reinstituting the kingship. But Genesis 9:6 says, you're still made in the image of God. The kingship wasn't cut off. There's a democratization of the kingship idea.
It's a renewal, though, of the charge, the command,
right.
The entrusting of the leadership.
Right, but it wasn't cut off, then reinstituted. It was just a reaffirmation, in a sense, of what was already the case, still the case. Through Noah, and it's right.
Still had it.
Right. And Genesis 5:1-3, after reaffirming that we're made in God's image, says, Adam bore a son in his own likeness, in his own image, which is, again, the dynastic succession, but democratized now. Everybody does that, not just kings, not our elite court circles.
Although there is a certain succession to eldest son.
Okay. Yeah. To talk about all the different points of view in Genesis are a complex thing.
Right.
Okay.
I was interested in the quick synopsis of you said that you thought Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 were very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Would
you like the synopsis? Genesis 2:15 speaks of the task of Adam as to kill and keep the garden, or to work and develop the garden and to preserve and protect it. That is a caretaker image, very similar to the stewardship idea. I mean, he really is an authority over the animals in the garden. He's not just one out of the dust of the ground. This there too. It's a different emphasis, but it's the same basic idea. A humble position, and yet we have power, we have authority, accountability as well, though. So that's how I would tie them together.
The image of God derived from prophets and responsibility imparted by God to representative creation. And for those individuals who cut themselves off from the life of God or who are cut off, would it not any longer be said that they are functioning in God's image?
One of the problems I have with my analysis, which, I mean, this is just very provisional. I'm working on a thesis on this topic now, is that I don't know if I can correlate totally all the different references in the Bible. They may be written with quite different points of view at certain times, and maybe I'm, flattening them out too much. state your question again. This is an introduction to your question, to my answer.
Well, I'm wondering if image has to do with office,
okay.
No longer
right.
That office.
I would say that one of the ways I approach it is say that there are at least two levels of meaning to the image of God. One is a structural thing. We're all in God's image in that we are all cultural beings who can shape history. We can change our environment. That's one basic sense of the rule I think we have, the caretaker of the garden. We can cultivate the garden. You can't lose that. I think that can be inhibited through having this idolatrous kind of religion, perhaps. Maybe that's why there was cultural stagnation until recently. Maybe. The other thing is, though, to be in the image of God fully, and this is where I appreciate what you said, is to manifest the traits that God has as he is revealed in covenant with us. That means we need to rule creation as God rules, with loving kindness, in wisdom, all those things. That's the New Testament emphasis. But it assumes, first of all the stuff I've been talking about. And I haven't even got into all that yet. That might be a last chapter of my thesis, for example. So we can lose that image, and it will need to be restored. That's how I'd answer the question.
Would you say that one of the dangerous things about the attractiveness of man worshiping himself arises out of this fact that it's almost deity in the sense of being made in God's image, but it's definitely mystic?
yeah, we really do have the power to change the world, and God has given it to us. And in a fundamental sense, what we do with that is up to us. But we'll suffer consequences. But yeah, I don't know exactly how to correlate Genesis 2, where the serpent says, "You shall be like God," and that's a temptation. I think Conrad has probably separated that a little too much from the image of God thing in Genesis 1, but they're connected. You can be like God in a valid sense, and you can be like God in a sense which is illegitimate.
It seems like our culture has accepted the plausibility of worshiping man as the best thing it knows to worship.
I just make a comment to that. If you are interested, a lot of the talk, but not everything, comes out of a book that I wrote with somebody else on the Christian worldview, which does analyze secular culture in terms of this model. If you want to look at it, it's on the book table. It's a cheap book. Unlike some other ones.
Let me try again something else. Here's a question. We often hear that our culture, secular humanism, exalts man and worships man. One of the interesting things that Jesus did was he challenged the inclinations of religious culture to place man more highly than they did. And I think specifically of when the Pharisees answered Jesus, said, "But we're children of Abraham." And Jesus said, "God can raise up children of Abraham out of these stones." And so much in the Christian evangelical academy now revolves around proclaiming that we are made in the image of God by virtue of our rationality, et cetera, et cetera. What would you say to an argument that says that that's not germane or intrinsic to what
well, two things I'd say. It's you can't find biblical justification for that statement. But also, that statement tends to make rationality the key thing about being human. I think that introduces elements that are just not biblical in general. I'm more attracted philosophically to something like an action theory, that we're not a center of rationality, but a center of responsibility to God with action. And rationality is one form of activity. Thinking is an act. It's not something elevated above all praxis, theory praxis, that kind of distinction. Today, we probably prefer praxis to theory, but it started out as theory was higher than praxis. So, I mean, I prefer a much more holistic, integrated, multifaceted dimension of active action from a center of a heart that serves God rather than an idol.
Well, thank you. I guess we'll have to...